We will have two opening messages to open this feast. The first will be by Tom Edwards from Perth, Australia. Go ahead.
Good evening, everybody over there. It's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you all because there, as in the opening prayer, the man said that there was more than two or three gathered in your name. Well, over here in Dongara, Western Australia, there's just the three of us, myself, Peter, and Cheryl, my wife. And it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you all, because we don't get to talk to the members of God's church, the brethren, very often. And here it's Thursday, here in Western Australia, it's Thursday morning, and it's very sunny. There's a nice easterly wind blowing. The sea is very calm. So we will all be able to go fishing tomorrow morning and without any difficulty. For your information, we are all quite well and we are all still alive and kicking. With no health problems just at present. Now, moving on, over here in Western Australia, we do have some tragedies from time to time, but we do seem to be relatively free from all of the woes and tribulations which are beginning to plague the world in increasing occurrence and intensity. We still have a few murders and rapes and pedophiles and all that over here, but we seem to have far less in other places of the world. That's why I always say that this is the best place in the world to live, and particularly at this time of the year. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles is very important, as it represents the culmination of all that has transpired in this world over the past 6,000 years, approximately anyway. And the last few years of this age of man are going to be horrific and definitely something to avoid, to just to say the least. The corruption which is rife throughout the world is also well and flourishing here in good old Oz. When you look at the world today, you can see that mankind cannot govern himself properly and that we need the return of Christ to set things in order and start the ball rolling again. Similar situation currently exists today with spiritual corruption within the churches of God. This is all a vicious spiritual attack by Satan. We need to be constantly aware and spiritually armed, as we are in the church, as we in the church are well known to Satan, and he is gunning for us in any way possible. And he hates us because we are going to receive what he tried to steal from God many thousands of years ago. And as time progresses, and as persecution against Christianity explodes, we will for sure come under notice initially, because we will be lumbered with all the other groups that call themselves Christian. But ultimate attention will especially be directed to the true churches of God. There is no escaping this. There is no escaping this for some of us. That's some of us anyway, but not all of us. As Revelation 12:17 mentioned, that Satan was furious with the woman, went to make war with the rest of her seed who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So because mankind has done such a terrible job of ruling this planet, God is allowing the evil rule of the beast and the false prophet to gain power over the whole world. Also, as the churches of God, since the time of Christ, has almost made a complete botch of their commission, Some of the saints also will experience punishment during the Great Tribulation. The parable of the 10 virgins and the letters to the 7 churches of Revelation 2 and 3 clearly point this out, that there is a heap of martyrdom to come among our peoples. How do we know these times are approaching? Let's have a short church history. Cheryl and I were called into the church at the end of 1972 in the aftermath of the 1975 fiasco, when the church was supposed to have gone to a place of safety early in 1972, around about February, I think. At that time, we couldn't see how they thought that, as there was so much unfulfilled prophecy. But we had not been had the benefit of sermons on the subject over a number of years. We had not been indoctrinated. It didn't take long, though, to become indoctrinated in the Petrus business. Gerald Waterhouse thought of that. He was such a dynamic speaker, and he had us hanging over on every word, sometimes for the full 5 hours, non-stop. He used to speak for a long time. A number of events occurred about which I think we were lied to over the years. Ministers left and were vilified by headquarters. Ken Westbury in 1974, when he started the Associated Churches of God. He has now died. Fred Colter in 1979. Gunsett Armstrong's immoral actions. Then there was a crisis in 1979 when the state tried to take over the church, and then Mr. Armstrong died, and Joseph Koch and his cohorts began the apostasy which caused God's church to be in the dismal state we see it today. But the rot had set in many years earlier. Even over here, there was adultery in the church. During the Feast of Tabernacles, this happened in the mid-1970s. We were all so shocked that this could actually happen in God's church. So now the church is in utter chaos. But when you look at the world, it is even worse. There's Islamic problem, North Korea, the Middle East, USA is on the verge of civil war, the recent massacre in Las Vegas, which is still on the news. And we're over here, we're getting it practically every day on every news broadcast. Hurricanes, floods, famines, droughts and wildfires, earthquakes and volcanoes. Regarding earthquakes and government corruption, there's a site called Dutch Sense, and he's a scientist, and he has figured out how to predict when earthquakes are going to occur. And we've been watching him for some years now, and he's been spot on practically all the time. And he has been taken off the internet, and he's forced to use subterfuge to get any of his message out. And it could only be the American government which is doing that. It's very, very sad, really, because it's the sort of thing that people need to know, that when an earthquake is going to occur, that they can take some steps to escape the death which will probably be hitting them. So we live in a very sorry world. And you add all this is a complete lack of morals. Wholesale slaughter of the unborn, the most innocent individuals in the world. And that now there is even talk of post-birth abortion. Can you believe it? Which is just another name for infanticide. Here in Australia, we're no different. Currently, we are undergoing a plebiscite to ascertain the nation's view on homosexual marriage. Well, personally, I believe that the vote from all the people is going to be yes. Those who want homosexual marriage are violent towards those who don't. It's difficult to openly support the no vote without being called a bigot. So things are really bad in the world, physically, spiritually, but we are here at the feast to step back from all of that. And that's basically what the feast is all about, to allow us to separate ourselves from the awful carnage which is going on around the world, the bad moral, lack of morals, bad attitudes, political corruption, and I'm quite disgusted about it all, which is going on. Now, all of these things are signs that we are nearing the end. The parable of the budding fig tree comes to mind over this, but I personally think that the figs are almost in full bloom and about to bear figs. And if we're not in the if we're not fully into the days of Noah just yet, I believe we're right at the beginning and heading into it full bore. As I said earlier, the churches of God are currently in a terrible state of apostasy and are doing terrible things to the brethren spiritually. I've experienced that in one group, and I know Mr. Roth has in the same group. And I find it particularly devastating, as my family and I used to attend a couple of those groups before God opened our minds and called us out. I heard recently the doctrinal error that some of these churches have got, and these are these ex-Worldwide Church of God churches, and they currently believe that we currently believe that we are already in the day of the Lord. Now, how they could believe something so wrong is I cannot fathom. And one of the larger groups has now come out also with a new policy allowing non-baptized people to actually attend the Passover service. Incredible. So what do we do about this? What should we be doing to protect ourselves from all the spiritual depredations and attacks that are coming upon us personally and against the churches of God? We are here at the Feast of Tabernacles to learn how to do that. And so we should really take care to attend to what's being said to us. Actually, what we should be doing is attending to what's spoken to us in the Beatitudes. Matthew 5 summarizes everything that we need to be to successfully grow in the greater knowledge of Jesus Christ. Matthew 5, mainly verses 3 to 6, says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." So we must be humble. We can't practice self-exaltation, because that is setting ourselves up as an idol and turning our back on God. Because those who are poor in spirit, well, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And verse 4, "Blessed are those who mourn." For what is happening in the world. Years ago in the church, there was a pervading attitude of them and us. Now, those outside the church in the world and us in the church getting blessed by God. We shouldn't have that attitude. We should actually mourn and sorrow for those people, because they are only like that in their ignorance. And because of God's plan of salvation for everyone, where he has blinded the whole world and opened his truth to just a few people who we happen to be fortunate enough to have been selected by God. We didn't choose him. He selected us to participate in this and to receive a chance to be a part of the bride of Christ and take part in the first resurrection, which is an absolute ultimate blessing that anybody can receive. And Feast of Tabernacles, which we are participating in now, is why we are here, to learn and to grow spiritually. And then also there's a number 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." This is the way we should be every day of our life. And it's very difficult to live up to those standards. And if we don't hunger and thirst after Christ's righteousness, we'll never attain it. Attending to the Beatitudes in our lives is what continue to honour our baptismal covenant. The agreement we made with God when we were baptized is a covenant. I've said it before that it's a covenant unto death, and we cannot renege on the agreement. God won't and will not permit us to do so without dire consequences. He holds us to it. Hebrews 10, 26 and 27 clearly shows this. All right. "For if we willfully go on sinning after receiving the knowledge of the truth, There is no longer any sacrifice for our sins, but a terrifying expectation of inevitable judgment, of fierce fire, which will devour the adversaries of God. That's the third resurrection. I know some people who left the church after losing faith, who believe that all that we believe in is just a big con and that we're just ripped off and they don't want any part of it. A person I knew for many years actually said that to me. Today we have the whole Bible, whereas the early first century Christian did not. So we in this church today, in the world today, have no excuse because the whole Bible is there. We have it all clearly explained about the blessings for obedience, cursings for disobedience. And we need to be cognizant of all of this every minute of our lives, every waking minute at least. We can't do much like that when we're asleep. Paul, the Apostle Paul, stresses that we must, no, it's essential that we grow in the measure and stature of Jesus Christ and study to show ourselves approved of God. So if we don't listen, be awake during services and study the Bible and watch our attitudes and watch our actions and our thoughts, we're not going to make it. That's just a fact. And it's going to, even though it's difficult to do all the things that we're required to do, God is merciful when we fail to do all these things, and He is only too ready to forgive us upon repentance when we turn and keep on, pick ourselves up and keep on trying. He wants us to keep on trying. So today in Church of God, we are living on the knife's edge. If we, and like a tightrope, you know, if we go to the right or the left, we fall to our deaths. So it's, the blade is sharp and it's very difficult to walk along it, but we must keep walking along it. It's vital that we do this and we stay aware of all the deception which is coming upon the Church of God to endeavour to get us all off the track and away from true doctrines. The Feast of Tabernacles is one of the best times to evaluate our dedication and commitment and take any remedial action. And we must definitely, without fail, obey the voice of God. When something gets said to us which indicates we are not doing what we should be doing, that we're not doing the right thing, we must wake up and listen to that voice and repent and change and do the right rather than the wrong. So we today have no excuse. As I said before, it is essential, to quote my son Peter, we must keep on keeping on. That's about it. Although we aren't there, I have enjoyed preparing this little speech and hope that you will find it useful. It's been an absolute blessing to be able to talk to everybody there, because we've known Mr. Roth and many of the other people in the church for many years. Ever since we got kicked out of PCG, that's when we met Mr. Roth. And we thank him, like to thank him for all the help that he's given us over the years. And so, that's it.
Before we have Mr. Roth speak for the second half of the message giving today, we're going to have some special music. It's by Mark Graham, who lives in the Cleveland area, I do believe, and he's written a lot of music. And he's going to sing and play his composition, One Thing I'd Like Them to Know.
To meet some children live in bodies. that will never be quite right. And there's nothing I can do but wish with all my arms around them. Tell them that there's only so much time to go. Soon the king will be here. Things will all be better. It's one thing I'd want them to know. More than they've won. Some have lost their fortunes, some have lost their sons, and some of them have lost so much they've nowhere left to fall. And though they may not listen, I want to tell them all. I just want to hold them, put my arms up them. Tell them that there's only so much time to go. Soon the king will be here. Things will all be better. It's one thing I'd want them to know. There will be so much that's right. The earth will be a garden. The world will all be light. But even more, I'm living for the chance to be there when we teach the broken people and give them hope again. I just want to hold my arms around them. Tell them that their sorrow finally now is through. The king is on his throne now. Things will all be better. It's one thing that I'd like to do. I just want to hold them, put my arms around them. Tell them that there's only so much time to go. Soon the king will be here. Things will all be better. It's one thing I'd want them to know.
Good evening, everyone. That was a good evening. It was really interesting to hear from the people in Australia and realizing that, in fact, they face or are living through the same kind of situations that we are living through here in the United States. But I can remember when I made a trip over there, that was back in those Philadelphia days, and I realized that things were definitely not anywhere near as bad in Australia as they were in the United States. I didn't see any graffiti. It was just an entirely different situation. You could feel the difference. You could go any place and there, you had no fear. There, our relatives, we had relatives over there and they were just living just like we used to live back in the 30s and 40s here in the United States. So I figured that gave them, they're about 10 years behind us in the difficulties that we are facing in the degradation of society that we are facing. And so
It was an interesting comparison to hear them, to hear Mr. Edwards. And I really appreciate the time and effort that he took to put into this presentation for us. And so at this time, I'm going to ask every one of you a question. You know, you all traveled long distances, flew here by airplane, and spent a lot of time in automobiles getting here, and everybody seems to be really happy that they got here, right? I mean, and we all, at least as far as we know, have all arrived safely, and we're all, you know, involved in this presentation that we are going ahead with. So I asked the question, well, why is it that you did all of that? You know, a lot of people would look at this and say, man, these people are a little screwy. I mean, drive all the distance, travel all that, spend all that time, spend all that money in order to be here. And so I ask you a question. Why are you here? Well, you know, there are some answers here. Some are here because of friendship. I mean, we have, from past years, have friendships that we have carried on. For example, the Australians. You know, they are friends, our friends, and I talk to them occasionally on the telephone, and we write back and forth with different questions about what's going on and what different scriptures have, what meaning they have. So, you know, you could say, well, you know, we're here because of past friendships. Well, I don't know how strong that is. Or some are here, well, you know, this is a great time. Wow. We go out to eat. We can, we eat food that we normally would not become in, you know, have the opportunity to really, enjoy. And so, you know, this could, you know, we go, hiking, and we go rock climbing, and we go bowling, and we do all kinds of things together. And so, well, is this the reason we're here? To have a good time, and to have a good time that normally we couldn't really afford. We couldn't afford to go out and eat every night, enjoy really tremendous food. We just, you know, it's not where it's at. Then some are here because they've come along with others. Right? And they, we have two little boys. I'm sure that they're here because their parents are here. And so, you know, they prefer being with mom and dad. And then, it's a good thing. You know, they have, through the past years, have known that this is a good time really to be here. It's a fun time. And then, some are here, they share their good fortune with the other brethren through the year, because they are blessed, just like the hymns that we sang. You know, this is a blessing that God has given us. And that's really kind of an interesting thing and interesting way to look at it. And then there are those who may feel that they have to do this because this is something that God has commanded us to do. So we're here because we've been told to come here. That's really another, in a way, valid reason for being here. Now, that's the real kind of underlying principle here. It's the fact that this is commanded. Well, this is commanded. Is it really? Is there some place in the Bible where it says, "You will come to this feast," and this is what you have to do? Well, the scripture that we're going to take a close look at is, of course, Leviticus 23. So if we open our Bibles to the book of Leviticus and we go to chapter 23, I'm going to tell you right now that you may think that you know why you're here. But I'm not going to really tell you why you're here until tomorrow. Tomorrow is when you will really find out why you are here. But let's take a look at Leviticus 23, starting in verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts.'" So if we take a look at that, there's some important words to consider here, right? And the first word, of course, that you'd say, well, it says proclaim. And it's kind of an interesting thing that when you look at that word, and then you see he's going to proclaim to be holy convocations. Well, that word convocation comes in there, is the next important word, because we need to understand, well, this is a pretty important word. And actually, proclaim is 2063. And no, I'll take that back. 7121. That's proclaim. In Strong's, that's the number. And the number for convocation is 4744. So you would think, well, these are two really different words, right? Well, not so fast. Because if we look at these, at this particular number, and it's kind of interesting because I use this theological word book of the Old Testament, and you hear me talk about it a lot. Well, they have their own system of numbers. So when you look at Strong's numbers, you see two different numbers. But if you look under those two numbers, you will find that they relate the two words together. They're related words. It's rather interesting. And that number that they use is 2063. And so, if we open up our book to 2063 and look at the word, the difference is that particular word has the basic meaning, and that's what they're saying here. Whoops, wrong. And I got to make sure I stay on the right word, because I have another word we're going to look at. 2063, the basic meaning is I call out, or recite. And so you can understand why that word proclaim, it means call out. That's all. You proclaim, you call out, you proclaim it, you let everybody know. And in this case, he's telling Moses, you tell the children of Israel, you proclaim this, you tell them, you call it out, you make sure that they get the information. That's what that is. Now, the word convocation is 2063D. It's in the same basic area or type of word, but it has an entirely different meaning. And it's rather interesting that the scholars are able to put together this particular meaning for this word. And in this particular, their definition is convocation. I mean, they just take that word that the King James uses and they recite it. This designates, here's what they say. It designates the weekly Sabbath, Leviticus 23, verse 2. And so, we didn't read all the way, I guess. Now let me see. They say it's designated. You have to read, actually, you have to read verse 3. Verse 2 is not quite, doesn't quite cut it. Verse 3 says, 6 days you shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath, a solemn rest, a holy convocation. What do we do on the Sabbath? We come together. So we see that actually that fits the definition perfectly, and they're absolutely correct. They didn't quite go far enough on it. And however, the most unusual meaning is reserved for 7 special convocation Sabbaths. These were observed in the course of 5 annual feasts. So they said 5 annual feasts. So I thought, let me see. Well, here's what they list. The Passover, Feast of Tabernacle, the Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles were opened and closed with special convocation Sabbaths. Not true. We know that that's not correct. We know that the Passover is not opened with a convocation. But the first day of unleavened bread is it not? So that is the first day, actually, and the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, we have a convocation, don't we? Everyone gets together. So that is the first little sign that maybe they don't quite understand everything, but not too bad. And the Feast of Tabernacles, Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles were open and closed with special convocation Sabbaths. So now you have 4 of those right off the reel, right? The 2 on unleavened bread and the 2 that we have, for tabernacles, although they fail to recognize that actually tabernacles only has 1. But there's a second one, the 8th day. That is a second feast of convocation. So, I'll give them some slack on that one. let me see. These were observed in the course of 5 annual feasts, and they were opened and closed with special convocation Sabbaths, such as the weekly Sabbath as well. So the weekly Sabbath would be included in that. So we always say, we always think in terms of what? How many feasts? What are the feasts? We say 7, right? That's what we say. Well, this is true. If you are talking about annual feast days, because as soon as you say annual, what feast day do you leave out? The Sabbath. That's left out in the, out of the count, is it not? So then you have unleavened bread, you have Pentecost, you have trumpets, you have atonement, and you have tabernacles. Those would account for 5. But in fact, if you add the 2 convocations that are included in there, you would then have 7 convocations in those feast days, in those 5 feast days. So this is just kind of background information. So for you to remember that whenever you're looking at these technical manuals, in a sense where they're giving you the meanings of the words, you have to be circumspect about it. You have to look at it and say, well, is that really true? And so that's an important thing for us to recall. Now, let me see. Such days and the weekly Sabbath, included a formal summoning of the people to worship by the blasts of what? We know that. Remember? Not too long ago that we went through the trumpet blasts, and we recognized that there is only one kind of trumpet that should be used. That's the silver trumpet, not the ram's horn. It's the silver trumpet. And that was what was used to do all of the signaling as we went through that at the Feast of Trumpets. Everyone here remembers that? Yes. The interesting thing is now I have you all here in front of me. So, I might just stop and question someone here to see if they remember what was said on the Feast of Trumpets or, the Day of Atonement. So be sharp. So, okay. The Sabbath and the Day of Atonement were further distinguished by the divine prohibition, including all labor. Leviticus 23:3-31. Indeed, any pursuit of non-cultic goals, the godly were to focus their time and effort on worship. The six other special convocations did not exclude preparation of food, even though servile labor was prohibited. This is absolutely correct. We understand this, right? If we need to cook, but that's okay. You know, we can start a fire and do some cooking and preparation. This is a kind of a major part of all the feasts except Atonement, which my wife says is her favorite feast. And I can understand that. It's not difficult for me to understand that. So as we look at this, there is something that they mentioned. He mentioned, oh, wait a minute. We want to go. The next thing that we want to go to is, Exodus. We should really look at Exodus 23 and starting in verse 14. The reason that I want to go there is because it defines better for us the fact that these are the feasts. And so by going to Exodus, into the book of Exodus, we will see that they are defined for us. Exodus 23, and it says, three times you shall keep a feast to me in a year. So basically, there are three seasons. We're keeping, of course, obviously, we're keeping more than just three. There's three seasons is what this is telling us. And you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread seven days, as I commanded you at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. So we understand this. And if we continue on, we'll see the Feast of Harvest. That would be Pentecost, the Feast of Harvest. It's interesting that God uses that term here, right? Because we understand that term, where a lot, when I say a lot of believers who think, you know, they think they understand the Bible, do not understand the fact that Pentecost represents a very important day for us. That is, that day represents the time of the last trumpet or God's, the resurrection of God's people into immortal beings. That it is the height of blessing. There is no other blessing that you could have that could compare with that blessing. You may think, well, you know, if I was blessed with a lot of money, or if I was blessed with a beautiful wife, or if I was blessed with this or that. Well, yeah, those are all nice things to be blessed with, but they don't, it's just, there's no comparison. Absolutely none. So this is something for us to recognize in these feast days. Now, when we're looking at this, there's an interesting comparison here to this, let's see, this word for, I wanted to get that, Genesis 12, oh yes. There is another word here under this system of words. There actually, you have the call, and then you have partridge, called ones, summoned, and then proclamation, and that's Z, and then, of course, convocation, which was the D. So if we look under the C, we see that we have another, some interesting little sidelights to this particular, same particular word. And we can see this, I'll read something here. Most prominent usage here is to do with calling by the name of God. Usually the context has to do with critical or chronic need. Cain killed Abel. Man realized the full effect, of course, and began to call on God's name. And so the godly recognize the presence of the original sin by their continually calling on God. And if we look at that, this is some of the information that we have about that particular word. I want to look at the word for, actually, we're going to go to Genesis 17. And Genesis chapter 17, and this is going to be, I think, was rather interesting for me to find this, to realize that there is a relationship to the feast days here. And we are going to start by reading Revelation 17, verse 21. And it says, Genesis 17, verse 21. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. And you see, this is the same terminology that's applied to the feast days. The feast days are to occur at a set time, don't they? We know what day we should be looking for, and we should assemble on that day. And so here is, this is the same terminology. And so when you think about it, God is telling Abraham, he says, but my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. So, in other words, in the following year, at the same time, is when Isaac is going to come into existence. That's a pretty interesting statement, isn't it? Now, if we go to chapter 18, we're going to see, not only did he say it once, God said it twice. Chapter 18 and verse 14. Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. So this is a set time. And think about this. Here, good old Abraham, when he's told this, you know, he falls on his face laughing. You know, it's just like, wow. And then Sarah isn't any better. She's giggling in the tent when she hears the same thing. And so there was a kind of a disconnect of belief, I would say. Well, I mean, I can understand it. this is not a problem for me to understand why Abraham fell on his face and Sarah was giggling about this, what God told them. But the interesting thing about this is the fact that this was a set time. Well, when I was going through this, I was thinking, now wait a minute. If it's a set time, then why would he say this is a set time unless it would, at least we would get some idea when this time would be, right? And so I started thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, my thoughts turned to Genesis chapter 12. And there we're seeing something, we see a starting point here. And the starting point is, now the Lord had said to Abraham, that's 12:1, Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, and to a land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing, and I will bless you who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And Abraham departed. Okay, so he departed, as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So, well, we know. Well, we got a piece of information, right? 75 years old. Now, the next place that we need to go to kind of bring this whole time together would be Exodus chapter 12 and verse 41. Because way in the past, of course, now I've a lot of you should really know this. I shouldn't have to really explain it, but it just seems that it should be repeated because maybe it didn't set in the way it should have so that you totally understand it. And so Exodus 12:41, it says it came to pass. Now you got to here's the setting. They're leaving Egypt. This is the night that they leave Egypt, which, of course, would be, well, they actually started their trip on the 14th, and they stopped a little way into the 15th, which is the first day of unleavened bread. So this, what they're talking about here is the first day, the evening of the first day of unleavened bread. That's what this is. And so it says, and it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now, you put that out there, 430 years. You can search, as many maybe of you have, and you know, Where is there 430 years? There's no 430 years, is there? So when did this happen? You see, this is in, and he says to the very day, not the very week or the very month, but the very day. He's counting days. So when I read that and I puzzled over this for many years, because this is right to the day. But when you search, you can search the concordance, and there, this is the only 430 year period you've got. And so you wonder, what is he talking about? Well, they were leaving Egypt, right? Heading for where? The promised land. Who else was leaving someplace and heading for the promised land? Abraham, right? And how old was Abraham? 75, right? And how old was he when Isaac was born? 100. So that's 25 years, is it not? Right? Now we have another Genesis 15. Let's go to Genesis 15. And we're going to go no, we don't want Genesis 15. We want Genesis 21. Pardon me. Genesis 21 is where what we want. 21:8. No. What did I do? I get actually what I want here is that should be in 15, the thing that I want to talk about. She'll be it. What it is the fact that they'll be oh, no wonder I'm in Exodus. That's why it isn't working. I got to go to back to Genesis. Yes. I wasn't watching Carrot very closely. Then he said, this is God speaking to Abraham. Then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in the land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. So the question is, when did the four, you see, we've accounted for 25 years, have we not? But the affliction starts. When does the affliction of his offspring, not Abraham? You remember, it's very clear. It tells, it says that it will be your descendants. So in other words, his offspring are the ones that are going to be afflicted for 400 years. So when does that affliction start? Well, that's when we have to go to Genesis 21 instead of Exodus 21. Would not make any sense, and it didn't. Genesis 21, and in verse 9, well, actually what this is the weaning. Abraham, this is an important time. Isaac is going to be weaned. And so how old is he going to be weaned? Well, I'm saying that's 5 years. Well, why do I say it's 5 years? Well, we're going to find out why if we read this. And so the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian of whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore, and this word scoffing has a sexual connotation to it. So you can see this is recorded here. Well, why is it recorded? Because this is the first time that his offspring is going to be under duress. So it has to be 5 years. See, because you need 25 and 5 years old is when he comes under duress. So the next 400 years is going to take you to the 430 years to the day. So everyone should be able to understand this, you know, really quite clear. Can't tell what time it is.
Quarter to nine.
Well, that's a good time. Especially when that's what it is. We're at this point, I'm not going to go any further with this. We will kind of pick it up again, tomorrow afternoon. And that's when you will all have the answer as to why you are really here.